today, is it time to re-evaluate Tony Blair? And why does Saudi Arabia seem to have substantial stakes in two British newspapers?
I was standing outside the dressing rooms and there were, as you can imagine, a significant number of like security and bodyguards and the like. And then...
Hi, Mr. Blair. Paul Lewis.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for doing this today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
So where do we go?
Hi.
This is Shree.
Shree, it's a pleasure.
Nice
Hi.
To meet you.
Hello.
Hello.
The Guardian's associate editor, Paul Lewis, has been leading a series on populism and recently interviewed Tony Blair in front of a 2,000-strong crowd at the Barbican as part of it.
First things I noticed was like his whole family were there, you know, Cherie and the kids and everyone, and we shook hands and I was sort of struck by how stiff he seemed.
Do you have any other events coming up other than this in the near future?
Yeah, lots of different things, but not quite like this though. It's a different thing.
Because he's such a smooth operator, just seemed a bit almost sort of nervous.
Are they ready? Don't want to keep them waiting too long.
No, no. Right, that sounds like they're ready for us.
Good evening, welcome to tonight's Saturday
night. And then they called us on stage and we walked out and I was just struck by the wall of applause. It was a roar and it went on and it went on. And yes, the crowd was pro-Blair, almost fanatically so, it seemed to me. But these were people who paid for a ticket. I mean, who pays £20 to listen to someone they disagree with?
He's Labour's most electorally successful Prime Minister. But Tony Blair's legacy has been the source of bitter rows ever since he left office. Now he's back, making an impassioned plea over Brexit.
This is the most important decision this country's taken since the Second World War.
And defending his record as Prime Minister after Jeremy Corbyn lumped together Blair's Labour government with the Conservatives under Thatcher and Cameron.
I don't often respond to the leader of the Labour Party's attacks on the last Labour government, but enough is enough.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, the attempted rehabilitation of Tony Blair.
You know, I think like everyone in Britain, there are a handful of politicians that define our lives to some degree. And, you know, they tend to be the people who were in Downing Street for significant periods of time. I was born in 1981. So, you know, when Blair was elected in 97, it was the first time the country had been run by a Labour Prime Minister.
18 long years, my party has been in opposition. It could only say it could not do. Today, we are charged with the deep responsibility of government. Today, enough of talking. It is time now to do. Thank you.
You know, I was at that age in my sort of mid to late teens getting more politicised. And I remember 1997 really well. And obviously, you know, for anyone on the left, it was a moment of real optimism that things were changing in a very dramatic way. It was a break with the past. And I think for lots of people, Blair still represents that. What do you remember of 97?
So I'm a year older than you. I was 17. I was just too young to vote. The main thing I remember was everyone was really excited and the teachers in my school came in the next day wearing little roses, little lapels roses. Mm. And I remember Dee Ream.
Singing in our things can only get better.
Things Can Only Get Better soundtrack. Yeah.
Remember that? Well, did you go out leafleting for them?
For the Labour Party. I did. Yeah, I did. I wasn't just leafleting. You know when you go to vote and there are people there with the sort of rosettes?
What were you in? Young Labour or something?
Yeah, I was. And it must have been really weird that people were sort of going in mine was not a Labour constituency, and there was this sort of 16-year-old sat there with a pen asking them how they voted. Blair and the Third Way and the possibility of a Labour government when I was in my mid-teens was what kind of got me into politics. But weirdly, Blair and the Iraq War and the introduction of tuition fees, you know, several years later is what really turned me off politics.
So Tony Blair won a landslide in 1997. Yeah.
And here you see the effect of Labour's attack on Scotland. No MPs left for the Tories there at all. In the north, nobody left. Here we have the Midlands and Wales, and very few of the foothills left, one or two of them there.
But he got 179 majority. And then he did that again in 2001. It was slightly reduced, but it was still 166. I mean, what did New Labour do in those early years that was exciting?
Win, I think, from the perspective of many Labour Party members at the time.
And Tony Blair has, just this weekend, been really defensive over his policy record. Corbyn had attacked failures over inequality and economic policies. But in that video that Blair's Institute tweeted...
The period 1997 to 2010 saw the most dramatic improvements in our public services.
He lists spending more on doctors and teachers, improving living standards, making people more socially mobile. When you think back, what were the early achievements?
I think many people on the left will say that there was a really significant slew of policies that made a real difference to Britain. The introduction of the minimum wage, Sure Start, you know, significant increase in spending in public services. Blair's supporters will say that the new Labour government stopped inequality from getting worse. And I think objectively, that's true. Although his critics on the left, including many Corbyn supporters, will argue that there wasn't the kind of fundamental structural change to the class system that they would like to see. Another significant Blair achievement, I think you'd have to say, is peace in Northern Ireland.
In doing what we have done today, we have carried out what I believe to be the will of the overwhelming majority of people here in Northern Ireland, the chance to live in peace.
So, yeah, I mean, there was also a whole host of things that were, many people on the left to say, hugely problematic. You know, the failure to get to grips with the financial industry. I mean, this was an incredibly good place to be a tax avoider, position on law and order, antisocial behaviour orders, and also just, I would say, a lot of the rhetoric and discourse around immigration, the dominant issue of the time was this whole controversy of, around bogus asylums or so-called bogus asylum seekers. And a whole succession of Labour Home Secretaries tried to outdo one another with tough, often quite divisive, I would actually say verging on nativist language around immigration. Actually, that was something that I did put to him at the event.
What we were presented with was evidence that basically what would happen is you had a normal system for immigration. But if you claimed asylum at the time, you leapt ahead of that and then basically were in the British system and pretty immovable from it. And so people used to come in who were essentially economic migrants and claim asylum. So the evidence that the system was being abused was, I'm afraid, overwhelming. If you go back and you look at the statements that ministers made at the time...
I have some of them here. David Blunkett, children of asylum seekers are swamping British schools. John Reid said migrants come to this country illegitimately and steal our benefits. Charles Clark, we should stop those trying to abuse our hospitality and place a burden on our society. Gordon Brown, memorably, British jobs for British workers. I mean, this is nationalist rhetoric, isn't it?
Yeah, but look, in each of those cases, by the way, and the Home Secretaries you were talking about, they were talking about the very specific issues around migration. I think you'll find if you read the whole of the speech, it will start with a defence of migration and then move on to say, but there are abuses.
Tony Blair took the decision to stand side by side with George W. Bush and take Britain into the Iraq War.
Mr. Speaker, I've never put the justification for action as regime change. We have to act within the terms set out in Resolution 1441, that is our legal base. But it is the reason why I say frankly that if we do act, we should do so with a clear conscience and a strong heart. I accept fully that those opposed to this course of action share my detestation of Saddam.
There were claims, remember the claims, of weapons of mass destruction being deployed in 45 minutes, There was sheer fury among parts of the electorate. Up to 2 million people took to the streets with those famous Blair banners.
We are here today to show Tony Blair and to tell him openly that if one country needs a regime change at the moment, it's Britain.
How did Iraq change Britain's perception of Tony Blair?
Well, I think it's hard to think of any single event that has done more to shape the legacy of a single politician than the Iraq War and Tony Blair. I mean, there are many, many, many people in this country and beyond who believe the Iraq War and Blair's complicity in that war, and actually his advocacy of it, was, you know, one of the most appalling, unjustifiable, immoral, unethical moments of modern British political history.
So obviously there was that incredibly heavy focus on Iraq at the time. But also in 2004, Blair decided not to put transitional controls on the new Eastern European countries joining the EU. How critical was that?
I mean, 2004 was, in retrospect, a really significant moment. This was a period when we had around a dozen mostly Central and Eastern European countries joining the EU. And famously, the Blair government decided not to impose accession controls and to essentially allow citizens of newly acceding countries from Central and Eastern Europe to come and work in the UK. And that did have a profound impact on some regions and towns and cities in this country that were very significantly changed by immigration.
And I was interested that Tony Blair admitted to you in your conversation that they had got the predictions of the numbers wrong.
Yeah, I think government predictions at the time were like between 5,000 and 13,000 people would come to the UK. In the end, it was sort of 20 times that number. And it was probably a net benefit to our economy. And for Blair, it was all about globalization. This notion that there was an inevitability to globalization, that we now existed in a global economy and we needed to be players in that. And therefore, immigration would be good for those reasons.
By now, Tony Blair is not as popular as he was when you were a fresh-faced 16-year-old. In 2005, a lot of people are quite surprised that he wins, but his majority goes down to 66 seats. In all this time, he's had this long-running feud with his Chancellor, Gordon Brown. Who can forget that? And finally, in 2007, he leaves office and Brown takes over.
And of course, it's hard to let go. But it's also right to let go for the country and for you, the party.
What do you think Blair's reputation was like at that point?
I think it was in tatters. But actually, what I think is interesting about Blair's reputation is it went from bad to worse because of what he decided to do in the 10 years after leaving Downing Street.
What was that?
Well, to put it maybe a bit crudely, make a lot of money. After Blair left Downing Street, he set up a business, a commercial operation. Now, exactly what he did is shrouded in a lot of mystery. It's all really quite opaque. But based upon what has been reported, it appears to be the case that he, you know, worked for JP Morgan, an investment bank in Abu Dhabi. And his critics would say of most concern was the work he did for a slew of autocratic governments, including Kazakhstan. You know, the estimates of how much money Blair have made range from, you know, sort of over £100 million.
£100 million?
Range from that. That was put to him a couple of years back, and he said it was a fifth of that.
£20 million.
That's...
I can do maths.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Conclusion everybody jumped to. I mean, we just don't know. It's all very opaque. He's never been very open or transparent about it. But I don't think that there can be any dispute that he made a lot of money out of the contacts and reputation that he built in public office.
So, Paul, first of all, let's just get one thing straight. Mm. Okay, my institute that is there, which is a not-for-profit institute, I spend 85% of my time on it. I've actually given away more money than I'm worth. And the truth is, I could spend the whole of my life making money if that's what I wanted to do, and I don't.
And so, you know, for me, you know, this is a really, really important point, because a lot of what we're seeing at the moment in politics is a belief among many people that political elites are detached and they're in it for themselves, that they're corrupt. Just on the bare face of making money out of relationships that you built when you were serving the public, Blair has indisputably done that. I'm not making the accusation that he himself is corrupt, but it doesn't smell good.
And you tried to ask him about some of this.
I did. There was a photograph that appeared last year of Blair and Matteo Salvini. It's actually on Matteo Salvini's Instagram account. The sort of pair of them are smiling. Salvini is probably Europe's best known right-wing populist. So it was a legitimate question to ask Blair what he was doing meeting with him.
And on his Instagram account last year, there was a photograph of you and him together.
Yeah.
What were you meeting him for? Can you tell us?
What was he doing?
Well, I don't know if the word lobbying is a word that Blair would accept, but he was working on behalf of the Southern Gas Corridor pipeline. This is a pipeline that goes from Azerbaijan to Europe, highly controversial in Italy. Salvini's party, the League, is in favour of it. His coalition partner in the Five Star Movement are bitterly opposed to this pipeline because of the environmental consequences.
You know, and what happened when you asked about it?
Now, I asked Blair about his encounter with Salvini, and the answer I got was sort of a little bit twisted.
You said you were partly there to talk about the Southern Gas Corridor pipeline. Were you paid to meet him? Were you there as a paid consultant?
No, I wasn't there. I wasn't paid to meet him, but it is one of the things I do, you know, I'm also...
But that's not part of your paid work, then?
No, it is part of my paid work, but I'm not paid to go to particular meetings, but I am the chairman of the panel that is doing that gas pipeline, and it's a partnership between BP and other players.
But on one hand, he said he sort of wasn't paid to meet with Salvini. On the other hand, he seemed to accept that he was paid for that role.
So Tony Blair, really toxic figure in society by 2015, when the Labour Party, having lost again, elects a left-wing MP who has repeatedly rebelled against Blair during their time in government. What does he think of Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, that was one of the things I asked him about, actually, because Blair has been quite explicit in describing Corbyn as a populist. And I think probably most political scientists would disagree with Blair on that analysis.
And he basically seemed to argue that a populist is someone who goes for headline-grabbing offers, and in particular, lots and lots of spending promises.
Many people on the left really hate the word populism because they think it's used by centrists like Tony Blair to draw a false equivalence between people on the right and people on the left.
Many times. I mean, just so people are clear, what specifically is it about Corbyn's politics or what he says or what he does that you think, specifically speaking, is populist?
What I think is populist is snatching at a headline without really thinking through what the implications are.
Personally, having spent 6 months looking at the subject of populism, I don't think Corbyn is a very good example of a populist. I don't think he's a consistent populist. Now, Blair has made that accusation several times. And the more I probed, this is my personal opinion, he really struggled to give a convincing argument as to why he might be.
Next comes 2016, and we have Brexit.
This election. And Sky News is projecting that the UK has voted out. The UK electorate has taken the historic decision to withdraw from the European Union after more than 40 years of membership. The expert working out...
Blair, like many centrists, is absolutely devastated by this result. But initially, he doesn't re-enter the debate. I remember there was quite a lot of talk about the fact that he was still a very toxic figure and that he wouldn't necessarily help. And then at some point, that changed. Why was that?
Well, I think there's two ways you could read what Blair is doing now. He's far more proactive. I mean, you turn on the radio, you'll hear him.
If you threaten Brussels with no deal... Okay.
Well, you state the obvious. Hang on. That's what you're doing.
If you threaten them with no deal... Yes,
doing more TV interviews. He's doing events like these. The charitable reading of that is Blair thinks that he has an important contribution to make, that there is nobody out there of maybe his stature who can make the argument for Remain as forcefully as he does. And, you know, you could take that further and say that Blair is and always was, and he definitely was, such a passionate sort of pro-European that this is a seismic political event in the country's history and he's got something to say about it. Another reading is actually somewhat more opportunistic or cynical. that Blair sees in Britain's political moment right now an opportunity to rehabilitate his own personal reputation.
And in this debate, he's having to talk a lot about immigration. I mean, we talked about the fact that in 2004, his policy, his very liberal policy on immigration, led to those large numbers of Eastern Europeans coming in that some people might argue led to the Brexit vote. He's now taken a harder line on immigration, and you asked him about that. What did he say?
He's gone from the politician who was sort of education, education, education to immigration, immigration, immigration. His answer to the populist moment is to, as he would phrase it, probably take more seriously the grievances of people who are concerned about immigration. Now, what that means exactly is a little bit unclear. And that's a school of thought that is shared by Hillary Clinton in the United States and several other people, if you like, on the centrist side of social democratic parties. But it's a really controversial point.
I mean, when Hillary Clinton made that argument on this podcast, we got a furious response from one of our own columnists, Nesrin Malik, and our own columnist, Aditya Chakraborty, really objected to Blair's arguments on this. And so if we step out of the fanatical Barbican for a minute, the Tony Blair lovers paying 20 quid for their tickets, what do you think? Has he been successful in trying to find a space in the politics of 2019?
Since I've come back from America, I've realised there's this new term, centrist dad, which didn't exist when I was last living in the UK.
I think they're quite bad at dancing.
Are they? So if you're a badly dancing centrist dad and you're listening to Blair on the radio, then I think you probably do feel that this is his time and he's being rehabilitated. On the other hand, if you're one of the many other people who feel quite fiercely that both the Iraq war and the failings of New Labour have been a blight on this country and are, you know, partly explain why we're in the mess that we're in today, absolutely not. And I think there's probably lots of people who are quite angry when they hear him on the radio and that they're angry at the idea that he should try to sort of rehabilitate his reputation this way. I mean, he's perfectly entitled to try and rehabilitate his reputation.
Is there any evidence whether there's been a shift in the direction of the centrist ads?
I think it's really interesting. We've just had Donald Trump in the country. Blair's approval rating in the UK is lower than Donald Trump's. And I think if you just look at politics generally, it doesn't strike me that there is a huge electoral appetite for his brand of centrist politics. I mean, in an interview with our colleague Patrick Wintour, he used the phrase sort of centrism had lost its mojo.
Could it get it back?
On the evidence of what's happening with Change UK, no. I just think politics is not formulated in a way right now that rewards that kind of moderation. Whether you're on the right or whether you're on the left, there is an appetite for systemic change, for big transformations. And almost by definition, that isn't what triangulated third way politics offers you.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We went to the Tony Blair Institute about some of the claims in this episode, and they responded to say that they felt that he was often misportrayed about what he did post-office. To be clear, they say, the advisory work, such as that around Kazakhstan, was focused on public service reform. Taking on such work requires a judgment on the direction of travel a country is taking, which in the case of Kazakhstan included working with modernising forces within the government. The spokesman added that Mr. Blair had built a not-for-profit institute which works in 15 different countries in Africa, has education programmes to promote coexistence around the world and continues to work on the Middle East. That was Paul Lewis. You can read his populism series at theguardian.com. Coming up, two British papers might soon be under investigation for links to Saudi Arabia. Now, two British papers, the Evening Standard and the Independent, might face investigation after a mysterious investor with, quote, strong links to the Saudi Arabian state, bought 30% of holdings in the publications. At the end of this month, the Culture Secretary, Jeremy Wright, will decide whether to intervene. Jim Waterson is the media editor at The Guardian.
What's happened is that unexpectedly, the government has said it's minded to launch an investigation into some of the people who own both the Evening Standard and the Independent. Now, Evgeny Lebedev, the Russian who has owned both of them for the last decade, sold a stake to a mysterious Saudi investor. First stake went in 2017, the second stake at the end of last year. And the government says it has concerns that they have strong links to the Saudi Arabian state, essentially saying that they're worried that the people who own a large chunk of two fairly substantial British outlets may be under the influence of the Saudi Arabian state in some form. The person who's named on all the documents is a Saudi banker called Sultan Mohammed Abuljadayel, who was described as being a rich investor at the time, the first in investment. But what it seems, based on what the government's saying, is that actually some of the money, at least, is indirectly coming from the Saudi state-owned bank. And they're asking, really, what's going on here? Why is it being funneled through the Cayman Islands to buy up both a London newspaper and a former newspaper-turned website? And what's the end purpose of this? Because Saudi Arabia is keen to burnish its image in the West. And is this part of that? Saudi Arabia is not known for having a great record when it comes to freedom of the press. It ranks very, very lowly on most world press freedom indices and also has very few truly free media outlets within its borders. And of course, there was last year the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. And that sort of raises a lot of concerns because the Saudi publishers are already doing joint ventures with The Independent. And of course, there's the fact that the former Chancellor George Osborne is now the editor of The Evening Standard, which now appears to be under investigation for whether it has strong Saudi links. Both The Independent and The Evening Standard insist that none of this has any impact on their day-to-day news agenda or how they pick stories, and it's certainly the case that they've covered a lot of the wrongdoing in Saudi Arabia in the last few months. But the really interesting thing is how the brands are being used. So following this deal, The Independent has licensed its name. So if you are looking for an Arabic version of The Independent, it will be run by a Saudi media company. They're adding a Turkish version, they're adding an Urdu version. So across the Middle East, you're soon going to find versions of The Independent. The insistence by the UK news outlets that there's no outside control, at the moment we have to take that at face value, barring anything else. What's unusual about this investigation is that the government wasn't expected to probe the investment, and they chose to do it because there is an opt-out on national security grounds if they're concerned about freedom of expression and the ability to portray the news fairly. This came out of the blue, and it follows press coverage by The Guardian and others into this highly unusual structure, which is seeing chunks of these outlets sold off to Cayman Islands companies where we don't really know who's controlling them. George Osborne is already having to make job cuts, which are affecting a lot of journalists at The Evening Standard. The Independent gets by on a relatively small staff, given its status. And if there is an issue with the investment that's keeping them going, then that could be really damaging for their future as news outlets.
A final decision on whether to proceed with the investigation is yet to be made. You can follow the story and read the full piece by Jim Waterson at theguardian.com. Before we go, some good news. Last month, we heard about Captain Ayapan, one of a number of seafarers abandoned at sea because of a dispute with a company. He hadn't seen his family for almost 2 years. Well, he's finally been paid 80% of his salary and has been reunited with his wife and daughter.
I can't describe what I felt. Hold my daughter again after so many days and nights. Thank you so much to all over supported for this our issues end with our struggles finally completed. Now we're going to start a new life.
You can read Karen McVeigh's latest article on his case at theguardian.com, and do go back to the 20th of May listing for Today in Focus and have a listen. It's called Abandoned at Sea. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao, Ian Chambers and India Rakerson. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.